Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison, August meeting, and our program today is on Robert Greene Ingersoll. Hopefully a number of you have brought favorite quotes from the 19th century orator. And Barbara has a brief biography she's going to read from a book. The title of the book, too.
It's called American Infidel, Robert G. Ingersoll. And I was, the reason I thought I would just read at least little bits of this biography was that, I mean, I'd heard the name, but I didn't really know who Ingersoll was. So the reading a little biography, of course, then I read a bunch of the other stuff in here, but at least it introduced me to who we were talking about. And this is a little foreword that Anne Gaylor wrote for this book, because it was republished by the Freedom from Religion Foundation. So she says, free thought flowered in the United States in the latter half of the 19th century, and its best known advocate was Robert Greene Ingersoll, a lawyer and Civil War officer who traveled the continent for 30 years speaking to capacity audiences. Although his repertoire included lectures on Shakespeare, Voltaire, and Burns, the largest crowds turned out to hear him denounce the Bible and religion.
Imagine anybody being able to do that now?
Yes. He was immensely popular, and his speaking fees ranged as high as $7,000.
Wow.
In an era of low wage and no income tax. That's amazing.
People paid $2 to go hear him.
Yeah. Ooh. Which is a lot.
Which is
money.
A lot of money.
He regularly attracted huge audiences, numbering the thousands. Ingersoll was the son of an impoverished itinerant pastor, and the church of his childhood was bleak indeed. Sunday was an ordeal beginning on Saturday night. When the sun fell below the horizon, Ingersoll said in later years, there was a darkness fell upon the house 10,000 times deeper than that of night. Nobody said a pleasant word, nobody laughed, nobody smiled. The children who looked the sickest were regarded as the most pious. That night, you could not even crack hickory nuts. So it goes on to talk about his father preaching hell and damnation. And it was interesting reading the book that in the end, by the time of his father's death, he was clearly a universalist.
The father was?
The father was, yes. Mm-hmm. So he went from this hell and damnation preacher to
a... he did just like you. He converted, Robert converted his father just like you converted his mother.
Apparently.
Barb, what religion was he preaching?
Presbyterian.
Presbyterian. Mm-hmm. He was not interested in genealogy. He wrote, I know little about my ancestors, not much more than they do about me. But his wife's family was known and renowned for its unorthodox religious views. Eva Parker Ingersoll was a rationalist and a strong influence on her husband's free thought evolvement. Her own parents were fans of Voltaire and Paine, and her grandmother, Sarah Buckman Parker, was described as a woman with vigorous intelligence, and she was an atheist. Mm-hmm. Eva Park Ingersoll was also an excellent cook. And when Ingersoll traveled from Peoria, which is where he was a lawyer, to small communities to argue cases in the early years of their marriage, he missed the comforts of home. He complained that the poor food and dreary lodgings in his letters, and he once said, life is too short to be wasted in this way. A good dinner lost is lost forever.
Profound.
He would lecture for longer, they were long, 2 hours or more. So he had to work for his money. And flowery in the fashion of the day. His letters contain memorable one-liners, such as, all religions are inconsistent with mental freedom. Shakespeare is my Bible. Burns is my hymn book. I do not borrow ideas. I have a factory of my own. I do not believe in putting out the sun to keep weeds from growing. And there's a great difference between fear and prudence. On his portly self swimming, a stack of hay struggling in waves regarding heaven, one world at a time. A biblical concept of people, eternal kindling wood. To a friend, you can have confidence in my prescription. I am not a doctor. Never kill people for a living. And of William Jennings Bryan.
Oh.
He talks, but he does not think. He was a devoted husband and father, and his letters to his family are filled with love. His daughter, Eva, married. She cut short her wedding trip because she was so homesick, and the family had an agreement that they would spend 6 months of the year at Eva's mansion on the Hudson River and 6 months in Ingersoll's home in New York. And they had an extended family under their roof and all kinds of company all the time because Eva Parker Ingersoll was such a good cook. And they loved having people around. So that's kind of in a nutshell. His biography, little bits and pieces of it.
And on the back of this book are quotes about Ingersoll by familiar names. I'm going to read the one by Robert M. LaFollette and pass it around if anybody else wants to read one of these quotes about Ingersoll. LaFollette said, "Freedom was what he preached. He wanted the shackles off everywhere. He wanted men to think boldly about all things. He demanded intellectual and moral courage. He wanted men to follow wherever truth might lead them. He was a rare, bold, heroic figure." I wanted to mention that we have another book from the library, The Letters of Robert G. Ingersoll, put together by his granddaughter. And there's a 66-page biography in here, and then an introduction to each section on the letters of Ingersoll. So this is available from the library. One of the things I found out was that as a teenager, he lived in Waukesha, Wisconsin in 1848, and in Milwaukee in 1849. And it was late in his life during a talk given in Janesville, Wisconsin, when he suffered a stroke, and although he went on talking for giving speaking engagements for several days, he was finally persuaded to see a doctor about that, and he lived a couple more years after that, but scaled back on his speaking engagements. And there's a quote here from Eva, the author editor here, about Ingersoll as a man with implacable hatred of prejudice, superstition, tyranny, and cruelty in every form.
What's the name of that book, Bob?
This is The Letters of Robert G. Ingersoll by Eva Ingersoll Wakefield.
That's the daughter?
Granddaughter. So does anybody have a quote they'd like to start off with from the writing of Ingersoll?
I think everybody's heard this one. And I think it's really appropriate after yesterday's big prayer. The prayer to Lusa, as Bill Maher called it.
Oh, no.
The hands that help are better than the lips that pray. It's one of my favorite Ingersoll quotes. And he also said, with salt baptism is a good thing.
What kind of baptism?
With soap. Baptism is a good thing.
Which scandalized the clergy at the time.
No kidding.
But what was the reaction of the establishment to Ingersoll? Was there
a friend of three presidents. You know,
this is what's amazing. That this we think that we're so liberated in this day and age. But
they were way ahead of us. And this is, you know, that period of time
down at that corner.
Is when women were starting to go into the ministry. First accepted in the ministry. So, you know, in a lot of ways, it's a very liberal time.
Well, what women were in the Unitarian women, Universalist women, ministers?
Oh, sorry.
I think it gradually opened up, so some of the Baptists and the Methodists. I'm not sure about the Presbyterians.
Well, I always thought that we had, I don't know why that whole, you know, the people that were really active in the free thought movement at that time, it's not like today where it just seems like free thought is just suppressed at every corner.
Do you think it's self-suppression? Are we afraid to speak out?
Well, I think I think atheists are, you know, non-believers are starting to find their voice more, and they're not as afraid to, you know, speak out. And I mean, if we don't want to become a theocracy, then, you know, it's up to us to keep it from happening. But when I read stuff, you know, when I read about Ingersoll, I always found it astounding that he could get thousands of people to come and listen to him. Yeah. And I thought, what was the climate that was so different in those days?
Didn't have TV,
no radio.
Well, they didn't. Yeah. But you think now we have the internet and everything else, and it's still not, you know.
I think it's so loud on the other side.
There's more Christianity, or fundamentalism is so entrenched.
Being drowned out.
Yeah.
I'll venture a guess. There's so much choice now in the world that most people don't want to sift through the choices and find out what's best for them, i.e. you. It's much easier to go to a conventional church and say, this is how you believe, this is what you do with your life. Mm-hmm. So I think having a plethora of choice has, the human system can't do that. They got to narrow it down. And it's a lot of work to do that. The UU is a lot of work because you've got to come up with your own answers. And I don't think that most of the world's willing to do that.
Oh, yeah, most people are followers. They're not leaders.
Yeah, I agree. So, yeah.
Well, I'd like to go back to Ingersoll's language a little bit, but a couple of prefaces. One, having been a speech teacher and studied rhetoric and studied quite a bit the processes for how speeches became available. And Ingersoll falls in the category of his lectures becoming available because reporters from newspapers took shorthand and or in some other form recreated the speeches. And it's important to realize that there was a substantial amount of editing that took place in that process. Sometime, depending upon whether the reporter was favorable or unfavorable to the speaker. The second thing is that I'd like to give homage to Project Gutenberg because a lot of Ingersoll's writings are available on Project Gutenberg, and I recommend that as a source for Ingersoll. But anything else that is not in copyright that they've collected, and if you have an e-reader, Project Gutenberg's materials are available to run on your e-reader. And so you don't have to pay for books if you have a e-reader. And so I printed out and read two of his lectures. The first is the lecture on religious intolerance, and the second is on the hereafter. And I'd like to read just a few snippets from these, and I'm not going to tell you when I slip to the second one because it doesn't really matter. How anybody ever came to the conclusion that there was any God who demanded that you should feel sorrowful and miserable and even bleak 1/7 of the time is beyond my comprehension. Neither can I conceive how they can say that 1/7 of time is holy. There are 60,000-odd preachers in the United States. Some people regard them as a necessary evil. Some as an unnecessary evil. They will have less empty pews if they have less empty heads in the pulpit. The time will come when the preacher will become a teacher. In 1876, said the speaker, our forefathers retired God from politics They said all power comes from the people. They kept God out of the Constitution and allowed every state to settle the question for itself. Because every religion in this world is the work of man, every book that was ever written was written by man. Man existed before books. If otherwise, we might reasonably admit that there was such a thing as a sacred Bible. Nature gave man every idea that he ever had in the world, and nature will continue to give man his ideas so long as he exists. And then the last sentence. Man's inhumanity to man makes countless millions mourn.
Ingersoll was also a great supporter of science in the early days of many scientific discoveries, and he gave a talk about Humboldt, the great Alexander von Humboldt, 100 years after the birth of Humboldt, and I'm going to read excerpts from the conclusion of that because after praising Humboldt, he gets into his own views on various scientific areas. There are some truths, however, we should never forget. Superstition has always been the relentless enemy of science. Faith has been a hater of demonstration. Hypocrisy has been sincere only in its dread of truth. All religions are inconsistent with mental freedom. It is almost impossible to conceive of the completeness of the victory of that the church achieved over philosophy. For ages, science was utterly ignored, thought of as a poor slave. An ignorant priest was master of the world. Faith put out the eyes of the soul. The reason was a trembling coward, and imagination was set on fire of hell. Every human feeling was sought to be suppressed. Love was considered infinitely sinful. Pleasure was a road to eternal fire, and God was supposed to be happy only when his children were miserable. The world was governed by an almighty whim. Prayers could change the order of things, halt the grand procession of nature, could produce rain, avert pestilence, famine, and death in all its forms. Slowly, beautifully, like the coming of the dawn, came the grand truth that the universe is governed by law, that disease fastens itself upon good and upon the bad, that the tornado cannot be stopped by counting beads, that the rushing lava pauses not for bended knees, the lightning for clasped and uplifted hands, nor the cruel waves of the sea for prayer, that paying tithes causes rather than prevents famine, that pleasure is not sin, that happiness is the only good, that demons and gods exist only in the imagination, that faith is a lullaby sung to put the soul to sleep, that devotion is a bribe that fear offers to supposed power, that offering rewards in another world for obedience in this is simply buying a soul on credit, that knowledge consists in ascertaining the laws of nature, and that wisdom is the science of happiness. Finally, science found agriculture plowing with a stick, reaping with a sickle, commerce at the mercy of the treacherous waves and the inconstant winds. A world without books, without schools, man denying the authority of reason, employing his ingenuity in the manufacture of instruments of torture, in building inquisitions and cathedrals. It found the land filled with malicious monks, with persecuting Protestants, and the burners of men. It found a world full of fear, ignorance upon its knees, credulity the greatest virtue, women treated like beasts of burden, cruelty the only means of reformation. It found the world at the mercy of disease and famine, men trying to read their fates in the stars, and to tell their fortunes by signs and wonders, generals thinking to conquer their enemies by making the sign of the cross or by telling a rosary. So that's from his talk on Humboldt in 1869.
In coincidentally, in finally getting through the book on the family, which I'm not going to waste on you today, was reading just an excerpt in here in which one of the members says, and this would be from the fundamentalist point of view, believes what he believes because I have a solid foundation. I am protected. Unbelievers think there is no absolute truth. They trust feelings and experience. The power of truth is lost to them. But we don't have to change our conception of the truth for the culture because it's absolute. Its power is absolute. And this person who I'm quoting is looking for unity and absence of differences of opinion, which is nothing new to any of us. But I thought it was interesting that I had just read that when I started looking for my Ingersoll quotes on my computer and came up with his essay on truth. And I think I can get through all of it if it shut me off, Bob, if I'm taking too much time. Reading glasses are a thing. This has an 1897 date on it. I guess I'm assuming that's when it was written. Given. Every human being should be allowed to investigate the extent of his desire, his ability. The literature of the world should be open to him. Nothing prohibited, sealed, or hidden. No subject can be too sacred to be understood. Each person should be allowed to reach his own conclusions and to speak his honest thought. And I'd like to interject here that I think there are people who are very different from us and who disagree with us who also think they are speaking their honest thoughts. So
do they feel that everybody's speaking? That's the crux of it.
That's the point.
We're going to have different thoughts.
He who threatens the investigator with punishment here, which reflects what you had said, or hereafter, is an enemy of the human race. And he who tries to bribe the investigator with the promise of eternal joy is a traitor to his fellow men. There is no real investigation without freedom. Freedom from the fear of gods and men. So all investigation, all experiment should be pursued in the light of reason. Every man should be true to himself, true to the inward light. And again, I think he's using a generic man. I've given a wife who was pushing reason and got him into this in the first place. I don't think he's sexist. Each man in the laboratory of his own mind and for himself alone should test the so-called facts, the theories of all the world. Truth in accordance with his reason should be his guide and master. To love the truth thus perceived as mental virtue, intellectual purity. This is true manhood, this is freedom. To throw away your reason at the command of churches, popes, parties, kings, or gods is to be a serf, a slave. It is not simply the right, but it is the duty of every man to think, to investigate for himself. And every man who tries to prevent this by force or fear is doing all he can to degrade and enslave his fellow men. Every man should be mentally honest. He should preserve as his most precious jewel the perfect veracity of his soul. He should examine all questions presented to his mind without prejudice, unbiased by hatred or love, by desire or fear. His object and his only object should be to find the truth. He knows if he listens to reason that truth is not dangerous, that error is. He should weigh the evidence, the arguments in honest scales, scales that passion or interest cannot change. He should care nothing for authority, nothing for names, customs, or creeds, nothing for anything that his reason does not say is true. Of his world, he should be the sovereign, and his soul should wear the purple. From his dominions should be banished the hosts of force and fear. He should be intellectually hospitable. Prejudice, egotism, hatred, contempt, disdain are the enemies of truth and progress.
Some of the letters in this collection of letters are an exchange between him and a Christian minister, where he was clearly appreciative of the minister's willingness to accept him, and they accepted each other. And here. Another one of his talks is in praise of the differences among people, where he says we each have our own thoughts and we should each be free to follow our own conscience.
I have one that I've got. This is actually from the list that readings that Bob had sent us that I particularly like. Instead of loving a God, we love each other. Instead of the religion of the sky, the religion of this world, the religion of the family, the love of husband for wife, of wife for husband, for the love of all for children. So that now the real religion is, let us live for each other, let us live for this world without regard for the past and fear for the future. Let us use the faculties and our powers for the benefit of ourselves and others, knowing that if there be another world, the same philosophy that gives us joy here will make us happy there.
Well said.
That's good.
And the other one was, the more a man knows, the more willing he is to learn. The less a man knows, the more positive he is that he knows everything.
That's really good.
Yeah.
And that one quote reminded me of the one of, don't worry about have it one world at a time.
Right. Yeah. You do good here, you'll be okay there.
You know much about him. He ran for office several times, didn't he, for like the Senate?
Yeah.
What state?
He ran in Peoria against Kellogg for the, I think it was Illinois seat.
Wasn't he a district attorney or something like that?
He was appointed district attorney, but left before the end of the term for, I forget what it was.
I know when he ran against Kellogg, he lost.
Yeah, he never won.
He never won, and he was nominated for governor at one point. And did not become the nominated candidate.
Oh, for governor of Illinois.
Mm. Did he come close? Was it really considered close elections?
The primary?
I don't know what the exact results were.
Well, it's of interest because people say, if you're an atheist,
you can never. That's why I was asking.
Well, and I think when he ran against Kellogg, at that point, I don't think he was considering himself atheist at that point. I think he was moving in that direction.
At one point where he had been outspoken, he was nominated at a convention, and the author thought that he had the support of about 3/4 of the people there. Maybe that was when Kellogg was the more less extreme candidate. That he lost the nomination because of his outspokenness.
Got it.
That people, even though they supported him, didn't think he would be good to run in the election.
And at that point that he ran against Kellogg, he was considered a, Lincoln Douglas, he was considered a Douglasite.
Douglas Democrat.
Because he felt like that a vote for Lincoln was a vote for dissolution of the Union, that it would lead to the Civil War, which it did. But then later on he changed.
Changed parties.
He was
a Republican.
The Tea Party became a Republican.
He became a Republican.
Which at that point was the party of, the anti-slavery.
Right, it's not the same as Republican today.
Very different.
Yeah, he was strongly in support of abolition of slavery and then the rights of women.
Maybe we could annoy the Tea Partiers and the Republicans by saying he was one of the Republican heroes of the 19th century.
That is annoying.
Still, it makes you wonder, where is the Robert Ingersoll today? Who's the spokesperson?
Religulous.
Yeah, it doesn't look like the way it's...
As in Caligula.
Yeah.
It's all about Ingersoll.
This book, by the way, is very... I found it quite well written. I didn't read it all, but I was picking out sections, and it was very, very readable. I tend not to be a biography fan, but this was very readable.
It's from the Monroe Public Library,
yes.
So when you return, you take it out.
One of the things I remember him talking about as far as his childhood, He said that you would go to church on Sunday all day long, mm-hmm. and you couldn't even move your legs. If you did, you would get beat when you were went home. Like little kids, you know how they kick their feet? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You had to sit perfectly still for hours and hours. And he was very adamantly opposed to, you know, like, I think, I don't know the actual quote about what kind of Bible, or what kind of God would, you know, tell you to beat your own children when he killed his own. And he was very, I think that was probably maybe one of his ongoing themes, was that, you know, children need love rather than this harsh, you know, treatment that he had as a child himself.
I would like to know more about his wife's influence in the whole family. Well, it sounds like she was very important, mm-hmm. and yet she was apparently willing to be in the background cooking the
cooking
meals,
right? Well, maybe that's where she liked to be.
Well, I have an interesting quote here from Elizabeth Cady Stanton,
yeah.
mm-hmm. Who says that no other loss outside of my own family could have filled me with such sorrow. This must have been his death. The future historian will rank him as one of the heroes of the 19th century. So that's rather strong feminist.
Yeah. So why didn't it happen? Huh? So why didn't it happen?
Yeah.
But we're working.
I mean, you know.
Yeah, you're right.
Nobody knows him like Clarence Darrow or Brian.
Certainly nobody has ever learned about Ingersoll in your high school history.
The evidence of people like Darrow and Bryan is because of Inherit the Wind.
Well, so
all we need is a good play that comes.
Right. Good movie of Ingersoll's life. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of Darrow, here's a quote from Clarence Darrow about Ingersoll. One of the bravest, grandest champions of human liberty the world has ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark Twain also commented on it. How handsome he looked as he stood on that table in the midst of those 500 shouting men and poured the molten silver from his lips. What an organ his human speech when it employed by a master.
But there's a whole period of history that I don't think is covered all that much. You can get it in biographies of certain characters in the late 19th century, but it comes out, Oscar Wilde, for example, he made his second living after the plays, basically by going around America and giving lectures. Mm-hmm. So there's, I mean, you get the impression if you read these different characters' stories about it, that there are these basic lecture tours going around the country. Mm-hmm. All sorts of characters, Mark Twain, Wilde, Darrow, and I think it's brought up to the, it's a very important portion of American history because it sort of brought into the forefront free thinking, which moved into the late 19th, early 20th century, where we were receptive to a lot, and this is where I come in because I read the history of science, a lot of really interesting forefronts where the whole public was looking forward to the advancement of science.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't even have to be a good scientist, you could just go on the lecture circuit, talk about what scientific discoveries you were going on, and pretty much make your fortune. You don't have anything like that today, sort of pushing people forward, which is, I think, why a lot of unfortunate people are going into these pictures of, these religions, which basically, you know, you're supposed to, the hope is now that you'll go into heaven and stuff like that. Whereas in these times, they saw the future and that was increasing. So one of the topics I like to talk about with people in the Solidarity Sing-Along is that there's so much more potential in America today than we are investing in at all. And I'm talking about human potential, work potential, et cetera, like that. And we need discussions more like that these days. We don't really have them. Obama started it with his change and go forward, not backwards stuff, but I mean, it was just one lone voice and he wasn't really paying attention to it after he got elected, basically. But these guys, they had that. All these lecture tours, you know, they were going forward, talking about new ways of thinking of things and all that sort of stuff, and I think it really benefited the nation and the world when it happened.
There's a much higher level of intellectual discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Common working people. Mm-hmm. Scientific and political discussion. Whereas now, well, it's the situation comedies.
Right. Well, I think it was really coming for it, too. I mean, if you read Oscar Wilde's stories about when he showed up in these mining towns in the middle of the country, he really felt that no matter what he talked about in terms of whatever intellectual discussion, they were really hungry for, you know, some more stuff.
Do you think the loss of the town square, I mean, quite literally the mm-hmm. town square, the place where people gather mm-hmm. To talk and argue and stuff, we don't really have mm-mm. that anymore.
We have multiple town squares. It's called the internet.
Mm-hmm. But the internet,
between, you know, you can get on a very good blog that discusses things that you're interested in, and if you get the right one that isn't being invaded by people who don't know anything more than a four-letter word, you can get into very good, thoughtful, informative discussions. But the kind of unification that takes place when people gather in the town square for something of this caliber, it's not happening on the internet as far as I know. It's you know, people over in this camp discussing their stuff, people here discussing their stuff, etc.
With like people.
With like people.
Right. There isn't the confrontation. And we build roads and suburbs and people move from their front porch to their backyard.
I was just going to say the front porch. People.
Mm-hmm. Besides the town square. Or,
yeah. People used to, that would be, you know, your community was your community. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now it's in your backyard and put a fence up.
Right. And the front porch went the way of air conditioning.
I took my mom for a ride yesterday and we drove through Middleton Village and I thought, this is supposed to be the area where everybody's sitting out on their front porch. And she goes, there's nobody living in these houses, are there? I'm like, no, I think they're all inside, but the door's shut. The air conditioning.
The air conditioning is really, you know, something that...
Sure.
On the nice weather times.
People's interest is really shallow today, too, though.
People's
the general public, the interest is really shallow.
It's disgusting when you open up the paper, mm-hmm. and even in the state journal, it's who won on American Idol.
Oh, sports.
And it's like...
Yeah. Yeah.
Who cares?
Headlines like that.
Yeah, headlines like that. And I mean, you hear nothing about anybody that died in any war. You know, we've just totally taken the intelligence of the society and dumbed it down way down.
Right, and because that's the common experience. You know, what people mm-hmm. see on American Idol or something
with very little
value is the common experience. Some TV show that I never watch. So I'm out of the culture.
At least you know that.
Yeah, I at least got that far. But I mean, there's lots of things like that that are like the only common cultural experience that people have, and that's what they talk about. It's really, you know,
because
nobody's talking
those are supposed to be reality.
Thoreau or so Plato.
Because they're, you know, anybody becoming a nobody becoming a star.
Bertrand Russell.
Yeah.
Well, I think people actually were more intellectual back in the 1800s, just because they had to read. They had to, you know, if they were fortunate to even have a library anywhere near mm-hmm. them.
Well, strangely, there was more time to be pensive back then too, because mm-hmm. they didn't have any mechanisms to do things fast.
Yeah, people getting together.
We live so fast today
and expect everything to be.
But people worked really hard back then, and you think. I think about how my grandparents lived and how you worked from sun up to sundown.
Right. Because but a farmer in his field,
if you were a farmer,
would be thinking.
You grew all your own food. I mean, you were self-sufficient. You made your own clothes. I mean, it took time.
But if you were,
I knit for fun.
If you were in the Sauk City Church, though, they brought, and those were mostly, you know, rural folk, farmed, a lot of farmers. But they brought lecturers in from Madison to speak in German, because the church was still, the community still spoke German. But they would, you know, on in a horse and buggy, you know, bring lecturers from Madison out to Sauk City to speak. That was one of the what made that church one of the hubs mm-hmm. of the mm-hmm. community.
Right.
In so many ways that
more intellectual happenings.
Yeah.
Did the rest of the citizens come to some of these?
I think that that speaking thing was very popular.
And I think
they
there
didn't
were a
have
lot
that many sources of entertainment.
Right, exactly.
Multiple day events because you travel that far. You know, you're not.
My mother said the big thing was the county fair. Mm-hmm. That was they looked forward to that all year,
right?
Because mm-hmm. it was like the one time you could actually, you know, go get mm-hmm. ice cream.
Right. I mean, there's that, or the circus came to town.
Yeah.
I mean, you didn't get together.
Yeah.
No. Well, you couldn't.
Yeah.
You know.
And one thing I mentioned that I don't think you guys heard at the other end was the Chautauquas.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the tent lectures.
Uh-huh.
And, it's interesting, I had grandparents who, all my grandparents were homesteaders out west. And they both would go, I think they went to Chautauquas, but maybe they were selective as to who they had, because this was also one of the families was, I mean, nobody played baseball or cards or anything on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. it was kind of...
They also had the Grange back then.
Split in their interests, I think. Mm-hmm. They still stuck very rigidly to the religion, but they also were very open, I think, to speakers coming through.
They'd probably even go to Ingersoll if he came there.
They might have. Mm-hmm. They might have. They might have gone home and had a big discussion about it and mm-hmm. disagreed with what he said, but they probably might have gone.
Well, they're also, at that time, they also, the people who worked in factories would pay someone to read to them while they were working on the assembly line.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. So they would pay readers to come in and read Dickens or Shakespeare or something.
Wow.
So, because it was boring work in the factory.
Yeah, sure.
Well, did the boss pay them or did
the No, I think no,
people
I, the people
by.
Would,
Damn,
yeah,
unions.
The people paid them.
Unions.
Unions, yeah, the unions would bring them in.
Yeah.
No
speakers.
What state
was that going Poland. Paid sculptors to come in and make statues and out of salt in the salt mine.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Very very elaborate cathedrals underground.
Uh-huh. Now, did the union pay for that? Or
yeah. yeah.
I wonder if tent revivals were less popular than speakers. They were saying coming together for a speaker. A minister coming in a tent revival during that time, would they?
Well, they were big where
I'm just
yeah,
saying.
They were big too.
So I guess what I'm saying is that kind of communal thing was important back then.
Yeah.
And it could attract equal numbers.
Yeah.
And hopefully, I don't know. I mean, well, I think the tenor is maybe the intellectual discussions attracted more people
mm-hmm.
than a conventional tent. Revival.
It's fire and brimstone type speech.
Yeah, well, as Ingersoll said, it was a scary thing to do, so I'd go up to intellectual debate. I wouldn't go hear a minister tell me I was a piece of crap.
Right.
Well, William Jennings Bryan, with his Cross of Gold speech,
uh-huh.
Drew thousands.
Uh-huh.
So he would be in a tent revival
well,
situation? Or?
Politically, tent revival.
Oh. Well, it's like the Elmer Gantry.
It's two different sort of moods, though. The tent revivals, salvations, that sort of thing, but the intellectual discussions, the featured speakers, you know, like Ingersoll, Twain, those guys, they're sort of, you know, curiosity things,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we don't really have that with television these days. Al Gore, vice president, you know, the guy.
okay.
I might have heard of him.
And he wrote this interesting book, but it had an interesting thesis that what you get is on television is you get these heads and you can talk back to them but they won't talk back to you.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So you don't really get anywhere in terms of a good discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, for example, these American Idol type shows might be more popular because you actually, you know, talk back to them even more by voting.
To get to vote.
So you have a feedback.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah, because otherwise television is all one way.
I don't think there was an audience discussion time.
No.
No, but people voted for $10.
But if you went out there.
Then you might talk to your friends afterwards.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure that they were topics of conversation in the community for months.
Yeah.
And there were occasions when he was asked to write an article for a magazine on condition that someone would write a response and then he would have a chance to respond back and forth. So there were some exchanges with prominent clergy, for example, in published works.
On Project Gutenberg, there's a whole volume of interviews with him, the different media interviews.
Yeah, I think anything that came along in those days was, you know, I mean, people were starved for for anything, mm-hmm. intellectual or energy. My grandfather worked his way through college performing with one of his fraternity brothers all around upstate New York, and it was his, I think one of them was more serious, and then his was more lighthearted, mm-hmm. things with an accent and stuff, but that's how they, I mean, that's how they worked their way through college, was going around to all these little towns.
It was a big thing out west, too.
Speaking.
They would have people that would bring pianos with them, because nobody had a piano, or the town, they didn't even have one, so they would travel with pianos. And they'd set up, you know, huge musical venues.
They would also play in, like what was, might have been the equivalent of 5 and 10. This is how my cousin learned how to play piano, is going down listening to the piano player that came out from New York to play the new music. Mm-hmm. She'd go sit.
Oh, that's what they played, the new sheet music.
Mm-hmm. She'd go sit right next to him and listen, but she was a little girl. They couldn't afford a teacher, so she'd go listen, go home and try it, and then she'd go listen to the same piece again and go home and try a little more. That's how she learned.
My grandmother probably graduated from high school in the early 1880s, and then she went to an elocution school in Boston, a school which still exists. Wow. She had a 2-year degree in elocution, and then she and another young lady would go around with a chaperone to New England towns all over the place, mm-hmm. and do their recitations. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I guess they earned enough money to support themselves. Mm-hmm. And, we occasionally get her to do one for us when we were kids, but.
The notion of spectacle and drama, I think, crosses all of this, and I think this is certainly Ingersoll is a good orator. And you've got, I mean, when I was a kid, I went to revival services. I went to one every night for 2 weeks one time, got in trouble because I didn't get my chemistry lesson done. But it was this was exciting stuff. I mean,
something
you get someone up there that waves their arms and.
And you didn't have to agree with them.
Yeah.
To still find it entertaining.
Yeah, but it is the entertainment value, which I think is also the value of a lot of the megachurches, especially in suburbia or exurbia and out in rural areas where it's big entertainment, it's fun, they program a lot of things that people have a good time doing. And
some of them are like rock
concerts.
But the
intellectual level is just
music.
Sometimes it's there and sometimes it isn't.
This week on Bill Maher, he had Neil deGrasse Tyson, the astrophysicist, was on there.
Jeez.
And anyway, yes. Bill Maher was talking about how badly we needed a preacher of science.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, good.
Oh, well
good
said.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One of the things they've done in Washington, D.C., I believe it's the Washington Area Humanist Society, is have an annual Ingersoll Oratory Contest,
mm-hmm.
where mm-hmm. people would select from the writing of Ingersoll speeches he gave and have a 3, 4, or 5 minute excerpt and be judged on who gave the best presentation. They've done that for a couple of years, and they weren't doing it again this year. But they may next year, and that's one of the ideas that's been suggested for the Mad Corps gathering at the Will Maher Center on September 25th. If there are enough people who want to do an Ingersoll Oratory Contest, we could do that as part of the program.
We need Ingersoll.
No. We need Ingersoll the Musical.
You can come and
cosplay.
Where's Andrew Lloyd Webber when you need him?
Yep.
There are videos on the internet of the Washington, and I guess they did some of them put on costumes too.
That style of oratory isn't what we're comfortable with now, especially you usually try to always be very temperate, you know, and
right.
another point of view and so on.
Yeah, you could be a bit bombastic. But when you're talking to an audience of thousands without modern amplification equipment, you got to be big.
Yeah.
Is Al sitting there?
He was.
No. I think he left.
He left there. Oh, he is.
Is he too?
Judy.
First time I heard Obama
Judy.
Live, he was talking about the union workers down there in Selma. And boy.
Yeah, I wish you could get a little bit of that fire, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, because now the fiery ones are the ones that are crazy.
The
part of it is
the talent damnation ones.
Well, on the Tea Party, the only thing that's wrong in the world is we have a government.
And I've always wondered why people who hate the government want to run for political office. I can't figure that out.
They're
ready. Well, that's what Walker did.
Yeah.
It's not about hating the government, it's about wanting to get more money.
Right. I think there is a lot to be said, however, about drama and oratory. If people, unfortunately, you can really toy with people's emotions this way, and that bothers me a lot.
Yeah.
But if it's honest oratory that's, the power of persuasion without the power of deception, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. There's one thing to persuade when you've got the reason behind you and when you've got some pretty doggone good facts behind you, but the deception is what I think is extremely bothersome. So if oratory can be used in a way that's really in a positive way, of course our positive is not anybody else, it may not be anybody else's positive, but I think we can sit around here and be very, very, what to others may be extremely boring people, because we aren't flamboyant. So I think there's certainly advantages to really dynamic, dramatic oratory.
Flamboyance is like a podium or something.
I think Ingersoll combined flamboyance with a devotion to the truth.
Like that.
In those days, maybe. Today they may have a sign up that says applause.
Well, are there any concluding remarks about Ingersoll?
Sounds
it's
like
his birthday
man.
This
I never
week.
Heard of
him before. Is this the birthday?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My father
gets
worship
the 11th.
Him.
He's like 178
right.
or
some people celebrate August 11th as Ingersoll Day because that's the date of his birth.
His birthday's coming up.
October 11th?
No.
August
11th.
August 11th. So this is the month.
So it's good you had a birth.
There's a method to his madness.
We'll see.
Yeah, that'll be it. Yeah, we should all tell Google that they need to put an
tell
Ingersoll.
Tell Google
to
put an Ingersoll.
Oh,
yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
You can draw. Can you draw a little
Ingersoll
with
they did one for Lucy's 100th birthday.
Yeah, they've got Lucy on there now.
Oh, yeah.
Her
yeah.
Her
100th birthday.
It was yesterday.
Yeah. Has a little TV with the I'm a Lucy.
Yeah, yeah.
The complete works of Ingersoll are available online. So you can read all his writing. And
today
thank
he
you.
Would, today he would be called Bobby G.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.